Omaha Public Radio presents another lecture program from Creighton University on Noon Forum. We'll hear the conclusion of a talk by Gabriel Bach, retired justice of the Israeli Supreme Court, and a prosecutor at the war crimes trial of Adolf Eichmann in the spring of 1961. Justice Bach's remarks were delivered as the Creighton University School of Law's International Law Lecture. The title of his presentation is The 50th Anniversary of the Trial of Adolf Eichmann. Justice Bach's appearance was co-sponsored by the Institute for Holocaust Education, the QTAC Rock Foundation, the Heartland Holocaust Education Fund of the Jewish Federation of Omaha, the Anti-Defamation League, Plain States Region, the Community Relations Committee of the Jewish Federation of Omaha, the Cardozo Society of the Jewish Federation of Omaha, Fraser Stryker Law Firm, the Klutznik Chair in Jewish Civilization at Creighton University, and Marks Claire Richards, LLC. This program was recorded by Omaha Public Radio on Thursday evening, September 22, 2011, for broadcast at this time. The opinions expressed are those of the speaker and do not necessarily represent those of Creighton University, the sponsoring organizations, KIOS-FM, or the Omaha Public School District. Here now to reintroduce the speaker is Michael J. Kelly, Professor of Law and Associate Dean for International Programs and Faculty Research at the Creighton University School of Law.
Justice Gabriel Bach was born in Germany in 1927, and in 1938, exactly 2 weeks before the Night of Broken Glass, or Kristallnacht, the Bach family moved to Holland. 1 month before the German invasion of Holland in 1940, they relocated to Jerusalem. He's always been one step ahead of the game. He was later told he was the only Jew of his school in Amsterdam to have survived the war. Justice Bach studied law in England, receiving his Bachelor of Laws degree with honors from University College London, and was admitted to the bar in 1950 in Lincoln's Inn, England. Justice Bach sought a life of public service in the state attorney's office back in Israel. Aside from the Eichmann case, he also appeared in dozens of internationally known criminal and civil cases, like the Rohan case, which involved the burning of the Al-Aqsa Mosque, major espionage cases, including the Meyer-Lansky case, the cases brought against Rabbi Kahana and Archbishop Capucci, and many cases of importance in constitutional law concerning the occupied areas. He later became the state attorney general for Israel. He has also presented Israeli interests before foreign courts, tribunals, and international conferences. In March 1982, he was appointed as a justice of the Israeli Supreme Court, a position he held until 1997, when he reached the mandatory retirement age. He is a colonel in the Israeli Army Reserves. He served in the Advocate General's Department for many years and continues to serve as a judge of the Army Court of Appeals. About the Eichmann case, 1961 was a momentous year in the annals of international jurisprudence. Adolf Eichmann, the notorious Nazi leader who had engineered the machinery of the Holocaust, had been captured and brought to Jerusalem to stand trial for his crimes against humanity and against the Jewish people. His trial opened on April 11, 1961. The next day, Soviet cosmonaut Yuri Gagarin became the first man in space. 5 days after that, the Bay of Pigs invasion had begun. Yet with such momentous events swirling around us, Israelis and the world paid attention to what was happening in Jerusalem in this historic trial, in the capital city of a new and besieged country, only 13 years old, hewn from the sands of the Levant, hard by the eastern Mediterranean Sea. Adolf Eichmann was born in 1914, the son of a middle-class businessman, Karl Eichmann. He joined the Austrian branch of the SS in 1932 when he was 18 years old and later accepted as a full SS member. His SS number was 45326. 2 years later, he had joined Heyerdahl's SD, the elite party security service. His initial task was to collect information on prominent Freemasons in Germany, but he was soon assigned to the Jewish section. His voluntary immigration program evolved into a policy of forced deportation by the outbreak of World War II. It was during this period that he proposed his plan to deport all Jews to the island of Madagascar off the coast of East Africa, That plan was obviously never adopted. But Eichmann's logistical prowess during the war, coupled with his growing power, secured him the post-war sobriquet as the architect of the Holocaust. By war's end, he had been captured by the U.S. Army, but the Americans did not know his true identity. He slipped out of U.S. custody in 1946 and hid in Germany for two more years. By 1948, he had obtained a landing permit for Argentina, but could not use it without a visa. So he then left for Italy, and by 1950, he was posing as a refugee named Ricardo Clement. Eichmann then obtained a humanitarian passport from the Red Cross, together with his visa for Argentina, and sailed by ship for South America on July 14, 1950. For the next decade, he continued his secret life, working in various jobs in and around Buenos Aires, including stints in a factory, laundry business, as a water engineer, and even as a rabbit farmer. He had also managed to relocate his family to be with him. It was during this time that Israeli intelligence had begun to follow leads in his direction, and by 1960, they had devised plans to capture him, which they did on May 11th of that year, as Eichmann was returning home from work. He was snatched from the street, gagged, blindfolded, bundled into a car, and taken to a Mossad safe house, where he remained for a week, awaiting the next regularly scheduled El Al flight back to Israel. Getting him out of the country without alerting the Argentinian authorities was a challenge. The intelligence unit sent one of their own agents to the hospital with possible brain damage from an alleged car accident. By May 20th, the agent had shown sufficient progress to be discharged and flown home to his native Israel. Mossad then substituted Eichmann's assumed name and photograph on the discharge form, drugged him, and boarded the plane to Tel Aviv dressed as El Al employees. He was then transported to Israel to be prosecuted in Jerusalem as a war criminal. Security was tight, and Eichmann appeared in the dock accompanied by two uniformed guards behind a bulletproof glass at all times. Justice Bach was appointed to the position of senior prosecutor for the trial that began in the spring of 1961. He was the lead coordinator for the investigation of Eichmann's crimes, acting as the legal advisor to the police bureau and preparing the case for trial. He served as one of three principal prosecutors during the trial of Eichmann, one of the most significant trials in the annals of criminal justice. And here we are in 2011, commemorating the 50th anniversary of that historic occasion. From unspeakable crimes in Nazi-occupied Europe to a hiding place in Latin America to a trial in the Middle East, to this commemoration in Omaha, Nebraska. I have a newsreel from the opening day in court that captures the first moments.
In Jerusalem, the trial of Adolf Eichmann begins, reviving memories of the Nazi horrors of the Second World War. Entering the bulletproof prisoner's box is the man charged with the annihilation of millions of Jews in Nazi death camps. Searching problems of conscience and of international law will be raised by this trial, one of the most stirring of modern times. Eichmann himself is impassive as the three judges who will decide his fate enter. Now, after 15 years in hiding and 1 year after his sensational abduction from Argentina, Adolf Eichmann is indicted on 15 counts of crimes against the Jewish people and crimes against humanity.
He accused, together with others, during the period 1939 to 1945, caused the killing of millions of Jews in his capacity as the person responsible for the execution of the Nazi plan for the physical extermination of the Jews, known as the final solution of the Jewish problem.
Eichmann's attorney, Dr. Robert Savatius, opens by denying the legality of the trial and questions the jurisdiction obtained by Eichmann's forcible capture. Dr. Savatius further suggests that Eichmann be tried by a neutral or international tribunal. Israeli Attorney General Gideon Hausner, the chief prosecutor, replies that no one except the State of Israel has sought to bring Eichmann to justice and cites the Nuremberg war crimes trials as precedent for this trial. Throughout, Eichmann remains icy calm his fate at last in the scales of justice.
And now it is my distinct honor and pleasure to give you Justice Gabriel Bach of Israel.
When we speak of moments, I mean, you know, we had witnesses and from everywhere. There was only one witness in the trial, who I think the only person in the world that I heard about who was already inside a gas chamber with the doors closed and who could tell the story. How come? He was a child, and he described how he, together with 200 other children, were pushed into the gas chamber in Auschwitz. And he described how the doors were closed and how it was absolutely dark. And he described how the children at first began to sing in order to give themselves courage. And then when nothing happened at first, the children began to cry and to shout. And then the door opened. Why? I mean, we had other evidence about that as well. A train had arrived in Auschwitz with potatoes, and there were not enough SS men to unload that train. So the commander, the SS commander, had the glorious idea, why not use some of the children who were in this gas chamber before they were killed to help unload the train? So they opened the door, and they took out 20 of the children who were nearest the door, and this boy was one of them. Then they closed the door. The other 180 were killed right away. But they had to; these 20 had to help unload the train. Afterwards, they were killed as well. But the commander had said that he had done some damage to one of the trucks by negligence. That's what the commander said. And the commander gave the instruction that he, before he is killed with the next group of children, that he should be flogged in the camp. And he was taken there, and the SS men who had to carry out the flogging took a liking to him. And he kept him as his batman, and who cleaned his shoes and who did his bath and so on. So this is how he managed to escape. He also described how he was in the gas chamber on that particular day. All the children who still could work were used for that for a few days before they were killed. But the ones who were too little or too small or too weak were sent to the gas chamber right away. Now, he was very thin and very weak and very small. And it was clear to him and to his elder brother, who was older than him, that they didn't want to examine every child. So they put up a sort of triangle and, you know, two vertical sticks and a horizontal one, and the children had to walk underneath that. And any child that didn't come up to a certain height was sent to the gas chamber right away. Now, he and his brother realized that he wouldn't make it, and that his brother took some stones and put it in the shoes of his little brother to make him a bit taller, and he held him up also, when they were walked underneath this gadget. But the SS man who was in charge saw that. And I think he either killed the brother right away or the brother was sent away. Anyway, he was sent to the gas chamber. Now, there were lots of cruel things in the Eichmann trial, but even for the Eichmann trial, that was something that... The judges were a bit dazed by that. So when this witness was over, they said, we have to make a break of 15 minutes. So I can tell you, after this witness that I told you about, that boy in the gas chamber, I went into my office during this quarter of an hour just to get to somehow to recover. And then the door burst open. And this young defense counsel came in, and he burst into hysterical weeping attack. He didn't want people to see him like that on the outside. I didn't want people to see him that way. So I closed the door, and I prepared coffee for him, and I treated him in order to enable him to continue. This was the first witness in the trial that I examined him. This was one case about this boy in the gas chamber. In that connection, sometimes, you know, people ask me, tell me, with all your objectivity and all your job as a prosecutor, didn't you have sometimes, or at certain moments, the feeling that you had some difficulty to continue, or just at least particular in a particular witness? Well, there was a moment like that. I should like to join that with you. You know, Eichmann usually sat in Berlin, pulled the strings, and his assistants worked in the various countries. But when the German army entered Hungary, you know, Hungary was on the side of the Germans under Admiral Horthy. He was their leader. They fought on the side of the Germans and the Italians, but they were not so much in favor of the deportation of the Jews. There were 500,000 Jews in Hungary. So at a certain stage in 44, 45, Horthy, that leader, thought the war was lost on the side of for the Germans, and he wanted to make a separate peace. And the Germans tried to prevent that, and the German army entered Hungary. There also was an arrangement between Hitler and Horthy. I'll talk about that later. Anyway, there was this arrangement. The German army came in, and Himmler gave the instruction. The master himself, that means Adolf Eichmann, has to go to Hungary to see to it that none of the Jews could escape or could make any resistance in Hungary. Because that was a year after, in the Warsaw Ghetto, the Jews who knew that death was waiting for them, and there was a very extreme resistance, and people fought the Nazis, and many of them were killed fighting. So Himmler wanted to prevent that, so he sent Eichmann to see to it that nothing like that should happen in Hungary. So Eichmann, interesting, he was there, he was still proud of what he did. One of the first things he did when he came to Hungary, he gave instructions that the first Jews from Hungary who came to Auschwitz, before they were put into the gas chambers, they had to write postcards to their friends and to their families. And what they had to write was dictated by Eichmann. They had to write, we are here in a beautiful country resort called Waldsee, lovely excursions in the neighborhood, very light work only, but not a lot of room. So come as quickly as possible in order to get the rooms that are still available here in the villas and the barracks that are still empty. Eichmann, when you remember that he even told us, I even added, bring good shoes with you for the excursions so that the army could afterwards take the shoes when these people were put into the gas chamber. Now, I was in charge also of all the evidence about Hungary, especially as Eichmann was there present, so we had the largest number of witnesses we had from Hungary. So while I presented the Hungarian case, I heard that there was a person in Israel who had such a postcard and was still alive. I managed to get hold of him, and I told him, come immediately to Jerusalem. He came at 11 o'clock at night. I tell you that because, usually I examine the witnesses very carefully before that. But this was nearing the end of the Hungarian case, and I never had more than 3 hours sleep during the whole of that trial. So when this man came at 11 o'clock at night, I just asked him, show me the postcard, translated to me from Hungarian to Hebrew, which he did. And then I said, what happened to your family? Tell me tomorrow morning when I call you as a witness. He also came at the last minute, so I had in the next morning, so I had no chance to talk to him. So I put him on the stand, asked him first about the postcard, which he did. He told us the story. And then I asked him, all right, so what happened to your family? He said, well, I had a wife, and I had a little daughter, 2.5 years old. And I had a son, 13, 14 years old. And we came out of that train in Auschwitz-Birkenau. It didn't mean anything to us. We came there with a few hundred people. And then they described the selection. There was an SS officer the woman to the left, the little girl to the left. Then he was asked, what was your profession? He said, I was an engineer in the army. So they said, he said, to the right. They said, when did you use him? And then he said, how old is your son? He said, 13, 14. So the SS man said, well, I have to examine that with my commander. It took a minute or two, and then he came back and he said to the boy, run after your mother. And then I looked at the witness. You could see in his eyes that he was back there. And he described what he saw. He said, I thought my son, doubt whether my son will find my wife, because in the meantime, about 100 or 200 people had walked in between. He said, I looked. I couldn't see my wife anymore. She was swallowed up in the crowd. I couldn't see my son anymore. He was swallowed up in the crowd. But my little daughter, she had a little red coat. And that red dot getting smaller and smaller, this is how my family disappeared from my life. Now, just by chance, my little daughter, 2.5 years exactly, and I had bought her a red coat 2 weeks before that. And the day before that, my wife, Ruth, had taken a picture of the two of us walking in the street, her with a red coat and me next to her. So when the witness said that, and I heard it for the first time, it shut off my throat completely. I suddenly couldn't utter a sound. The witness recovered and waited for the next question. The judge gave me a sign to continue. The television was on me, and I stood there. It's perhaps 3 minutes or so. I started playing with the documents, but sort of I couldn't say anything. And in fact, afterwards, I mean, at that time there was no television in Israel yet, but the American television broadcast that was sent to me later, and there I saw that for some reason or other the television man concentrated on me, and you could see me looking into the distance and not reacting anymore. I mean, I can tell you, until this very day, I can be in a football stadium, I can be in a restaurant, I can be in a street outside, and I suddenly feel my heart beating, and I turn around and I see either a little girl or a little boy in a red coat. I mean, that may be a banal little story, but for me, somehow, that represents the trial more than any other part. One other thing which certainly is very, very difficult to forget. Eichmann said during the trial that this was one of the worst crimes committed in history. So I was asked during the trial and afterwards whether I thought that that was meant, was said sincerely. From the point of view of the punishment, at any rate, that might have been of importance if he had shown that he had some regrets about what happened there. So I said, I'm sure that this was mere lip service towards the outside. So they said, why do you say that? I said, well, I could imagine. Theoretically, practically, I could imagine even a man like that, between the end of the war, 1945, and 1961, 16 years when the trial took place, I can't say that it's impossible that the eyes of such a person could be opened and that he could really feel some kind of regret. That is something which is a possibility. But here we had proof that in 1956, when he was already in the Argentine, he was visited by a Dutch journalist called Sassen, a fascist. And that man took his life story and on tape. And the idea was that he would publish this after Eichmann's death, a sort of life insurance for his family. But then when Eichmann was caught by our agents, he presented that to Life magazine, and there we managed to get it, the typewritten pages, but with Eichmann's amendments in his own handwriting. So no doubt about the authenticity of that. So Eichmann knew this man came from Holland, so he described to him how he went to Holland and he saw the trains leaving from Holland to Auschwitz. He said, das ist eine Pracht, war. It was marvelous to watch that. And then the Dutchman asked him, yes, but Mr. Eichmann, do you still feel sorry for what you have done? So he said, yes, I feel sorry for one thing, that I wasn't hard enough, that I wasn't tough enough, that I didn't fight these damn interventionists enough. And now you see the result, the creation of the State of Israel and the reemergence of that race there. So I said, if he said that in 1956, 11 years after the war, and now 5 years later in 61 when he's fighting for his life, he suddenly speaks of the gravest crime in history, I think I'm justified to be more than a bit skeptical, to put it mildly, of what he said there. One other thing, I mean, I don't want to go into too many details about the legal points, but I thought, of course, that during the preparation of the trial, what sort of possible defense could he bring forward? And one, perhaps the main point, was that, in fact, it was put forward by the defense, that Israel is a Jewish state. The court of law is a court of law representing that Jewish state. The Jews were the victims of these offenses committed by the Nazis. Now, justice has not only to be done, justice also has appeared to be done. And therefore, the argument could be brought forward that it doesn't sound just that a court representing the community of the victims, that they should judge a person who had done this to the Jewish people. And therefore, they should have left it to some other court and not just judged by an Israeli court. Now, legally, there's nothing in that. The whole idea of the criminal law is that instead of someone in his family had been murdered or where there has been a burglary, that they take law in their own hands and take revenge against a person. It is a court representing a certain community and a certain people and a certain country. It is that official court that judges such a person. As I said during the trial, if someone is found in Turkey and there is a rumor that, or some evidence that he wanted to commit high treason against England, it's not a Turkish court that will judge him, but an English court if they manage to get hold of him. So really there's no real justification for that. And I never forget, during the preparation of the trial, there was a professor from a European country. He also talked to me, and he made that also that remark about the victim and so on, whether it's just or not. Before I could answer, he said, Mr. Bach, show me the indictment. So I showed him the indictment, and he saw that we had charged Eichmann and his department that he not only persecuted and murdered Jews, but he also murdered gypsies, that he also murdered Russian commissars and certain people from Czechoslovakia and Poland and Russia and so on. And so this professor said, Mr. Bach, why did you charge him with that? Why didn't you leave that to a Russian court, a Czech court, a Polish court? So I said, wait a minute, 5 minutes ago, you said that you thought it was not just that a country representing a certain community or a certain country should judge someone who committed crimes against that people or their people. But you don't seem to have any problem with a Russian court, a Polish court, a Czech court. But when it comes to a court of a Jewish state, there suddenly you have some difficulty. Where the man had the decency to blush, and he said, well, I really don't know why I made the distinction. I'll examine it, I'll call you. I've never heard from him again, you see. but that was rather typical. And I want to tell you in that connection, I'll never forget the first moment of that trial when these judges with the Israeli emblem behind them got into this courtroom. And that man, whose only object in life had become to destroy that people, when he got up and stood to attention before an Israeli court, Israeli sovereign court of a sovereign nation, you know, the importance of the creation of the State of Israel suddenly became clearer to me than at any moment that had preceded, more than any demonstration or any parade or any article in the press or anything like that. You know, at that particular moment, I think that was a feeling we had all over Israel about the importance of the state of Israel as such. One other thing that is impossible to forget. We wanted to show a film, a documentary film, in the trial. We didn't want it to take too long because there was not enough time, but about 45 minutes. And I was asked by my colleagues to prepare that film. Now, for 3 days and three nights, I looked at all the films that existed, from Polish, Russian, German, American, English sources, Israeli sources, and so on, about Auschwitz and about the corpses in Bergen-Belsen and about any other place. And I prepared about 45-minute films. Now, out of fairness to the accused, I wanted to show him and his lawyer that film before we showed it to the court, that maybe he wanted to say something against the authenticity or the reliability of these films, etc. So without the judges, we took him into the courtroom. There were also some journalists present, and without the judges, and we showed him that film. Now, I knew the film, so I didn't look at the film. I looked at him. I wanted to see how he would react when he saw these really frightening pictures of these corpses, Bergen-Belsen, Auschwitz, death camp, gas chambers, etc. It was completely no reaction whatsoever. But then I saw that he suddenly spoke very excitedly to his warden next to him. So when the thing was over, I called that warden. I said, "Tell me, why was he suddenly so excited?" He said, "Yes, he had been promised that he would never be taken into the courtroom unless he wears his dark blue suit. And here they take him out in his gray suit, in his gray pullover, and they shouldn't promise him something like that if they don't intend to keep it. And he has to protest most violently that he had been taken in his gray suit and not his blue suit." That was the only thing that worried him, you see, when he saw those pictures. I also would like to hear maybe some about your opinion on that. In this film, I put in there was a little township in Holland where all the Jews from there were taken into the trains and sent to Auschwitz. And they were kept there for a few days, and then they were picked according to certain numbers and so on and taken away. Now, a film was prepared about that as well. I don't know who exactly took the film, but I got this film. And I'd put it inside these 45 minutes. Now, in that film, people are still rather nicely dressed. There were some children who were even dancing. There were some children who had toys in their hands. And some of them were smiling. And then they were put into this train and so on. But it didn't look all that terribly shocking because people were still behaving like ordinary people. So when my colleagues in the prosecution, when they saw that, they said, "Look, the film is relatively short. Now, why did you put that in? That's not so shocking. That is not so very exciting." And I had the impression that they had a little bit of the suspicion that I put it in because of my Dutch past, because I lived in Holland, and that I was interested in the Jewish community in Holland and to show how they were taken away, and that's why I couldn't refrain from putting it in. But that's not so. My impression was that, when you show these films about the thousands of corpses in Bergen-Belsen and the gas chambers, this is a sort of inferno that the ordinary person cannot identify with this. You cannot put yourself in that place. But when you see that little part of Holland, there you say, but for the grace of God goes you. You see, people can still imagine that could happen to them. And I mean, I show what happens later on. I show Auschwitz and I show these other places. But I thought that to put in a little piece where people were still relatively decently and normally dressed and were even smiled and had toys in their hands, that was important to give the picture as a whole. My colleagues agreed with me. Finally, and so the whole of that was put in. I just wanted to tell you, towards the end of the war, you know, with Eichmann, I think, I always am asked what sort of a person was he. And like in every, with every prisoner that I had to deal with, and every accused person, I never like to put to find someone as only one thing, only a murderer, only a bureaucrat, only a Nazi. People are never only something. People are a combination. People pass through stages of development. I thought that was also happening to him. But you could see that towards the end of the war, this had become an absolute obsession with him. He was completely identified with this. And when he said to his friends, "I know the war is lost, but I'm still going to win my war," and then he went to Auschwitz to get the death rate increased from 10,000 a day to 12,000 a day. When the German generals on the Eastern Front were clamoring for reinforcement, for ammunition, he managed to get priority for his death trains, must have known that he was actually harming Germany's war effort. I don't know whether you read about that. So at the end of the war, there was someone in Germany who suggested that every person, every German soldier who was one quarter Jewish, one Jewish grandfather or one Jewish grandmother, that he should either be castrated or sent to a concentration camp. Now, Eichmann supported that idea with all his heart, and he wrote and he did everything to protect, to further that. The one who was against was Keitel, that he was the commander of the German army, not out of humanitarian reasons, but he didn't want to weaken the army. He said these are thousands of soldiers. They'd been fighting with their comrades all during the war, and to lose them now, and it would be demoralizing for the whole of the army, he objected. Hitler supported Keitel in that. But Eichmann fought about that all the time. I mean, this was something which was really very, 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 very typical for him, until the last moment. I mean, I can give you lots of examples to show how Eichmann was completely identified with this. Also, you know, I examined all the other departments in the Gestapo. All of them were changed by rotation after 1 or 2 years. The only person who was kept as head of the Jewish department all during the war was Eichmann, because their superiors, they realized that he was sort of, with this fanaticism, completely identified with that purpose. Now, so if any person, when I was studying in England 12 years before that, I wrote a thesis on the death sentence. And I spent a whole night with someone who was sentenced to death, and up to the last minute accompanied him. And I wrote something against the death sentence, but then I had no problem, because I made then, at the time, one exception, and that was if for genocide someone was sentenced to death, and there might be a deterrent effect which would save tens of thousands, hundreds of thousands of people, there would be a justification. So I had no difficulty here. So if any person if really deserved that sentence, I'm no doubt it is Eichmann. I just want finally to tell you, you know, I'm regarded as an incorrigible optimist. And I must tell you that after the war, and now recently, sometimes, even for me, it's surprising that there 50 years have passed since the Eichmann trial, and the interest all over the world is growing from year to year. And I've been invited, and I've had contacts with Japan and with New Zealand and Australia and Sweden and Holland and Hungary, and of course America, and all the time people want to know. I mean, there are other cases where the Holocaust was mentioned, but always in a marginal way only. And never there was the contents, and the main part was never really on that. Only in the Eichmann trial, and for instance, in Germany, they have now, a few years ago, they decided that in every province in Germany, every one of the little states, there are parliaments. And in every parliament, every year, they devote a whole day in memory of the Holocaust. And they many of them have invited me to make speeches and to conduct the proceedings during these anniversary days in Germany. I was very friendly with the former German president of Germany, Gustav Heinemann, and he he wrote to me whenever there was something about Israel. When he was president, he wrote to me and he asked for a reply. When he was ex-president, he invited me to his home, and I could see that an attempt was made really to somehow change things for the better. What's even more important for me, whenever I come to these places, as it was last year, I came to three different places in Germany, they always ask me to meet young people from the schools. And they said, we want the children to know that things like that should never happen again. And therefore they asked me, just a few months ago I was in Saarbrücken and the president of the parliament there put flowers and a place in memory of the victims together with me. And he asked me to speak in the parliament. And then he asked me, would I be prepared to speak to 400 pupils in the schools, in the German schools? Now, that is something which really seems important to me. When I was in one of these states, suddenly they heard from the mayor of Berlin, heard that I was there, so he invited me to register me in the Golden Book of the town of Berlin. Now, that is something that is, of course, also something I remember how I was. That was the moment they asked me to sign the Golden Book of Berlin. When I thought how I left Germany in 1938, that was a rather strange feeling. I also must tell you, many of you must have heard about the Wannsee Conference. That was, Eichmann also told us. In 1941, Hitler decided to murder all the Jews in Europe. But at first, they didn't disclose that to the German ministries. So then in 1942, Eichmann and Heydrich, his commander in the SS, decided that they have to have a general meeting of all the director generals of all the ministries in order to confirm the action of the murder of all the millions of Jews. Now, Eichmann told us, he said, I and Heydrich were very worried at first because many of these director generals were jurists. And we thought when they look at this, when they hear that, they will say this is contrary to German law and they will criticize this, they will try to prevent it. He said, and then the evening went by and apart from some technical questions, nothing was put forward, no criticism whatsoever. So after the people left, Heydrich and I, we sat before the fireplace and we drank a schnapps, a brandy. Three times we drank to congratulate ourselves on our victory. Now, about 3 years ago, I was invited to speak with German television. And then afterwards, I was taken to this Villa Wannsee where this Congress was held with some German professors who also taught the Holocaust. And we were having coffee and I was sitting there and suddenly I saw we were sitting in front of a fireplace. So I said, tell me, is this the fireplace where Eichmann and Heydrich drank that toast? They said, exactly. So I must admit the coffee did stick in my throat a little bit. But anyway, now 2 years ago, 3 years ago, there was 65 years since the Wannsee Conference. And they had a big meeting with 300 people from all over Germany, leading positions. They came to the Villa Wannsee. And I was asked to make the main speech there and also I was responsible for the whole of that meeting. And this fireplace was still there. So in the middle of my speech, I told them that. So there were about 20 Germans sitting in front of this fireplace. You should have seen how they all moved aside. They didn't want to have that moment there. And, I don't want to go into details. I was invited to Halberstadt, and the way in which none of the Jews remained alive there. Not one escaped. But there was this group of non-Jews, and they were prepared. They put up a museum in favor of the Jews, and they invited me to meet with the young people there. I mean, these things are, in a way, helpful to see to it that really perhaps things like that should never happen again. Just before the end, I want to tell you, as I told you, the judges were very strict with us, and we never brought in any evidence that we thought might not be acceptable, but not connected with the Eichmann trial. But sometimes I came across documents that were not connected, and we didn't even use them. But I just want to share, to make you feel, you know, the sort of feelings we had during the investigation, which were not less frightening or terrifying than something of the other evidence. I want to tell you, one day I came across a document from the Ministry of Health. And there was a director general, a doctor, someone who'd finished a university degree. And at the time, I don't know how it is here, it's when you have in a hospital a blood bank, they also had a milk bank where women who had mother milk, where the children had died, or where they had too much, they could donate some of that milk to this milk bank for women who had no mother milk. So this man, this doctor, wrote to his minister. He said, I found out today that there was a Jewish woman, this name, she is one quarter Jewish, and she donated her milk to that milk bank without disclosing that she was one quarter Jewish. Now, what to do with this infamous woman? He used that word. I thought at first to make a showcase to show that she should be punished properly. But then I thought how demoralizing that could be for all Aryan mothers who might think that their children were contaminated by the milk that they got from this milk bank. And therefore, I think that this woman should just disappear in a concentration camp and never be heard of again. Now, you see, I mean, I was a child in Germany. I sometimes heard Hitler speeches. I saw the reactions, hysterical reactions of the crowd. I don't want to justify that, but at least I could understand it. But here, this man, a doctor, sitting in the quietness of his room, writing something like that, to me, any explanation is only partial. Just one more point. You know that before they had the gas chambers in the camps like Auschwitz and others, they had these gas vans where they had trucks with the exhaust going inside instead of outside. And men, women, and Jewish men, women, and children were put into these vans, and the exhaust went in there and then inside, and they were driving 30 to 40 kilometers, and the children and the people were slowly choking to their death, and the corpses were then sent into some kind of cemetery or something like that. Now, one day I came across a document written by a technical expert, who described to his superior how this worked. And then he wrote, after I described how these trucks work, I feel that out of humanitarian reasons, we have to do something in order to protect our poor SS drivers from the need to listen to the shrieks from behind that are getting softer and softer. And therefore, I have invented a soundproof wall between the driver and the part behind so that our poor SS drivers don't have to listen to this. Now, again, I want to describe you. When I got that document and I saw humanitarian reasons, I thought something to be done for these poor people behind who were slowly suffocating to their death. No, humanitarian reasons, that was the only struck our poor SS drivers, that they don't have to listen to the shrieks that are getting softer and softer. I mean, you know, for me, still, any kind of explanation for things like that are only partial explanations, and And these are moments that, you know, whatever happens, it's a sort of, I'm reminded of a certain moment or a certain piece of evidence. But as I said, just finally one more thing where I'm a little bit ashamed of. When we left Germany for Holland and we came to the Dutch border, some SS men came in and said, "Family Bach, raus, out, with your luggage." So we went with our piece of luggage, my father, my mother, my sister, and me, and they asked us, "Open your luggage," which we did. And then they took out everything, and they threw everything out into every different corner. And we didn't know what was happening. The train wanted to leave. We heard some telephone conversations going on in the neighboring rooms. And then my father begged, and "Wait for a minute until this is cleared up." And then SS men commander said, "All right, get out." So we quickly packed our things together. Here's something tall, there's something tall. That's also difficult to forget. Anyway, we ran towards the train. The train started to leave already. And an SS man came running after us, and he kicked me in a certain place behind, in a way that helped me a little bit, because with my luggage, I flew up these stairs, you know, which the train was already leaving a bit. But the fact that I was literally kicked out of Germany, that only later became sort of clear to me. And I'll never forget, you know, at first we didn't have enough courage, enough strength to go back to our compartments. We were sitting on our pieces of luggage. You know, no one said a word. It took a few minutes. And then a Dutch custom official came. He was not even particularly friendly, but he was correct. That caused the triggered off with me. Then I had some tears. The fact that someone in uniform spoke to us like human beings, that somehow caused that to happen. And now, a few years ago, I suddenly got a phone call from the German ambassador to Israel. And he said, "Mr. Bach, I want to talk to you. I want to tell you something. Our president and the German government have decided to award you our highest cross of distinction for Germany. Are you prepared to accept that?" I said, "Well, tell me first of all, what for? Why should I get that?" I said, "Well, what you did in the Eichmann trial. After the Eichmann trial, I cooperated with many German prosecutors in preparing cases against Nazis, especially in the death camps. I had some connection with German ministers. I was very friendly with the German president, Heinemann, etc. And lots of young Germans who come to Israel every year, in the Aktion Sühnezeichen, you know, that the people who are there who want to make up for what happened, and they are the ones who help in hospitals and other with survivors and so on. So I meet them as well." That was the reason. So they told me that I shouldn't refuse that. So I said, "All right." And so there was a meeting in the German embassy, the house of the German ambassador. And he invited people from Germany, Israel. It was a very nice meeting. And then he made a very nice speech. And then he asked me he gave me that cross of distinction. And then he asked me whether I want to say something. So I couldn't refrain. I told the story of how I was, this kick that I received at the border. And I said, somehow I feel that I didn't deserve that kick there. I somehow don't deserve that cross of distinction now. Maybe I shouldn't have done that. But I couldn't refrain myself from doing that. And the other day, someone reminded me of that from the German Bar Association. He agreed with me. He said that it was a proper thing to do that. But I don't know. But as I say, I have very, very many meetings now. And I was, for 30 years after that kick, I didn't want to visit Germany, not even in transit. But then there was the argument in the German parliament about to abolish the statute of limitation for Nazi crimes, and they asked our ministry, our government asked me to go to Germany and to talk to people of the German parliament in order to persuade them also to vote for the abolition of the statute of limitations so that Nazis, criminals, could stand trial. So I visited that. I was very nicely received. But just finally, the final case, I think I want to tell you one thing which impressed me more even than the nice acceptance that I had in Germany. I was going by train one day, and there was a young German sitting opposite me. And he was watching my trunk, and he saw there the label of Israel. At first he hesitated, and then he said, "Tell me, do you come from Israel?" I said, "Yes." He said, "You know, you're the first, not only the first Israeli that I've ever met, I even haven't met a Jew any time. But what happens doesn't let me rest. I feel I have to do something about it. I read all the books on Zionism, on Moshe Dayan, and on the army, and so on, and what happened in Israel. But that wasn't enough. So I started learning Hebrew. I know I'll never use it. I never come to Israel because I can't look into the eyes of people who are there. But I feel I have to do something. So I learned Hebrew. So I asked him for some words in Hebrew, and he did speak Hebrew. So I thought maybe a student of philosophy or someone like that. So I said, "Tell me, what are you studying?" He said, "No, I'm just working with a carpenter as an apprentice." And so if I hadn't by chance talked to him, I mean, he didn't want to come to Israel. He didn't know any Jew. But he felt that this is what happened. He has to do something. And he started to learn Hebrew. And I can tell you, I mean, moments like that I came across all over Germany, it makes me feel even more that, and I'm sure that the Eichmann trial did a lot to help in this direction, to see to it that really things like that hopefully will never happen again. Thank you very much.
You've been listening to a lecture from Creighton University on Noon Forum. We've heard the conclusion of a talk by Gabriel Bach, retired justice of the Israeli Supreme Court, and a prosecutor at the war crimes trial of Adolf Eichmann in the spring of 1961. The title of his presentation was The 50th Anniversary of the Trial of Adolf Eichmann. Justice Bach's remarks were delivered as a Creighton University School of Law's International Law Lecture. His appearance was co-sponsored by the Institute for Holocaust Education, the QTAC Rock Foundation, the Heartland Holocaust Education Fund of the Jewish Federation of Omaha, the Anti-Defamation League, Plain States Region, the Community Relations Committee of the Jewish Federation of Omaha, the Cardozo Society of the Jewish Federation of Omaha, Fraser Stryker Law Firm, the Klutznik Chair in Jewish Civilization at Creighton University, and Marks Claire Richards, LLC. This program was recorded by Omaha Public Radio on Thursday evening, September 22, 2011, for broadcast at this time. Special thanks to Cindy Workman, Associate Director of Public Relations at Creighton University, for helping to make the recording and broadcast of this program possible. Complete Noon Forum listings, as well as an archive of previous broadcasts, are available on our website, kios.org. Now, this is your producer and host, Bob Cote, thanking you for listening.